From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the pages of the New York Times, in the columns of journalist Nicholas Kristof. He's been traveling the world and reporting from some of the most dangerous locations for decades. In a year when we've debated whether ostensible journalists on television are puffing up their credentials or telling tall tales, Nicholas Kristof has been doing the real thing. He's uncovered war crimes, interviewed warlords, and written extensively about the plight of impoverished women. He's my guest in just a moment. But first, I want to bring in WXXI News Director Randy Gorbin on this very important Wednesday afternoon. Nice to see you, Randy.
Nice to see you, and nice to see some of my colleagues here. Of course, introducing Tom Peretti and also Leah Stacey, who we both know, and Tom can pitch as well as anyone can, but I'll take the break this time around.
I didn't drag him here to pitch, but we'll let anybody pitch.
I'll be doing that tomorrow.
You remember when I came over here, and it was a big decision coming over from commercial radio, but you really talked up public radio and the kind of journalism that is done here, and I can't say I've ever really looked back, and it's the kind of stuff that goes on with men like Evan Dawson every day.
Yeah, and made possible only by listener support.
We need you to make a donation if you can, whatever you can do, $5, $10, a sustaining member, a few dollars a month. You can call us at 454-6300, or you can just go to WXXI.org. Really a very easy way to do it, a secure site. And you can listen to not only great local folks, like those we have on the show today here in the studio, but, of course, Nicholas Kristof. We've heard so many people of national stature. Ken Burns will be coming on again, I believe, in the next month or so. And Evan, really, you've really tried to have a balance here between topics nationally and locally, and even the national topics, kind of bringing it home as we are today.
We do. And if our listeners are regular listeners of this program, but you're not a member, we'd love to hear from you right now. 454-6300. I will just say one other thing before we turn it over to Mr. Nicholas Kristof, which a lot of people have been waiting for. I do want to say that at the end of this month, we've got a fun event for members. We're trying to branch out, meet more people. It's been about a year since we've been on WEOS. We're proud of that, to be all throughout the Finger Lakes. And if you can pledge just $5 a month at $60 a year, my wife and I are hosting a little members-only event. You get two tickets for that at Ravine's Wine Cellars Saturday, May 30th. We'll be there, and all you've got to do is pledge $5 a month or more, and you've got two tickets, so we'll see you there. So,
and you've been there before. Great location. And
yeah,
you, as I remember, you were very popular there.
Well,
a lot of people showed up.
That's not for me to decide.
Well, hopefully you will be as popular right now. People calling at 454-6300.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Let me welcome New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Monroe Community College recently welcomed Mr. Kristof to Rochester as part of the annual MCC Scholars Day event. They've had some high-profile guests in recent years. Last year, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and this year MCC brought Nicholas Kristof, who's my guest now on Connections. Wonderful to have you, Mr. Kristof.
Thanks so much.
We often see American foreign policy turned into a kind of a point-scoring contest, an argument about toughness and bravado. I'm thinking first of the recent letter to Iranian leaders signed by 47 senators. We're about to see a presidential campaign really picking up, and I would love to know what you would ask the various candidates about foreign policy, apart from all of sort of the superfluous and the superficial pablum we see. What would you want to talk to them about?
Boy, I mean, it is so discouraging to look at the level of foreign policy discussion. I mean, one of the things that I think we just generally, don't fully appreciate is that there are always more problems in international relations than there are solutions, and that there aren't always ideal solutions. They're kind of least worst options sometimes, and I think that's very hard to translate into politics in America. I think also that, after 9/11, we relied hugely on the military toolbox to try to address terrorism, civil conflict, violence, and clearly you need that military toolbox. It can do things that no other toolbox can do. We need to have it. We need to use it periodically. But I think that we overused it and probably underused the education toolbox and the women's empowerment toolbox, and that over time they probably have a better record of transforming societies in ways that create more stability, more peace, and probably allies as well. And so I guess I'd ask the candidates, to what extent they appreciate that the leverage we have to change societies comes not only from drones, but also from girls with books.
You wrote a brilliant column recently on just that subject, and I'm going to get there in a moment. But you touched on the notion of the use of the military toolkit at certain times. And I tend to think in this country, apart from the neocons, there is not an appetite for American intervention, especially on a preemptive situation right now. So, but what should the standards be for deciding when we intervene?
I think that there will be times when it's in our national interest to use military force, but I think it's also important to not just look at what happens the next day, but what happens the next year. And, military force tends to be quite useful tactically. It tends to be less useful strategically because it often creates something of a nationalist backlash. And we've seen that everywhere from Vietnam to Iraq. I think that aside from those cases where we have interests at stake, we sometimes have values at stake. President Clinton said that his greatest foreign policy mistake was not intervening to stop the Rwandan genocide. I think that's right. We didn't really have interests at stake in Rwanda, but when 700,000 people are butchered in 6 weeks, we do have values at stake. And I think one has to be really careful about intervening, and we can't use military force to stop every mass atrocity, but because we can't do it everywhere, it does not necessarily mean we should do it nowhere.
I go back to 2013, and you were writing about what so many people were writing about, which is what should the United States do about Syria? And you wrote, quote, "Remember the Boston Massacre of 1770 from our history books in which 5 people were killed? Syria loses that many people every 45 minutes on average around the clock. If we were fighting against an incomparably harsher dictator, using chemical weapons on our own neighborhoods and dropping napalm-like substances on our children's schools, would we regard other countries as, quote, pro-peace if they sat on the fence as our dead piled up?" Well, today we see, Mr. Kristof, we see Bashar Assad's grip on power perhaps loosening as rebels have made some gains. Do you have any change of heart about what you felt and wrote about in 2013?
To some degree. I mean, I think circumstances have changed a little bit, but they may be changing back. So I think that we had an opportunity to support rebels, moderate rebels, back when the Syrian revolution began, and I think that President Obama made a mistake by not following the recommendation of Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus to do just that. I certainly don't think we should have sent American troops there. I do think we should have supported the Free Syrian Army at that point. And then gradually after that, by around the end of 2013, that window really seemed to be closing, and the Free Syrian Army pretty much collapsed. You know, there was a kind of, for the last year or so, I've sort of really not had any sense of what we can do effectively in Syria to mitigate the catastrophe. It, as you suggest, you know, now the Assad regime does again seem to be a little more wobbly, and I'm wondering if there may now be something of an opening to support the Free Syrian Army within Syria. But I'm just not sure. We have to always be careful that we're not going to do more harm than good. What we certainly can do is educate the 4 million Syrian refugees in the surrounding countries and make sure that they get an education so that this isn't perpetuated generation after generation.
You recently pointed to the story of Nabil Rajab, a human rights activist in Bahrain, recently imprisoned after he posted tweets critical of the repressive government. And you wrote, quote, "I hope that President Obama will remember the importance of demanding human rights standards, not just from our enemies, but also from allies like Bahrain." And, you know, I thought that column, that comment, Mr. Kristof, made me think of Secretary of State's John Kerry's comments praising the late Saudi King Abdullah, who died earlier this year, as some ostensible champion of women's rights. And they can't drive, they can't travel without male supervision. There's still so many things that women can't do. Are we holding our friends, for example, in Saudi Arabia accountable for when it comes to women's rights, education, and more?
I do believe that when somebody has just died, that it's probably not the moment to point out all their flaws. And so I understand Secretary Kerry's, you know, unwillingness at that moment to lambaste them. But it is true that we are very willing to point fingers at the human rights shortcomings of enemies, and we tend to be, much less willing to look at the flaws of our allies. And, you know, Saudi Arabia plays a central role in the Islamic world. It projects values throughout the Islamic world that are inimical often to our own, and I think inimical to our interests as well. I mean, when women not only can't drive, but don't play a significant role in society, when you have a lot of charity dollars that are rooted to extremist madrasas around the Islamic world, and when you have kind of basic religious intolerance, you know, there are no churches allowed in Saudi Arabia, people bringing in Bibles can have them confiscated, then I think that is something that we should speak up about. I think that, you know, this notion that in diplomacy one has to always keep quiet, I think is a mistake. Sure, you know, maybe the funeral isn't quite the right moment, but we do have values as well as interests. And I think in the case of countries that tend to project radicalism throughout the Islamic world, we should speak up more.
Talking to Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and best-selling author. And Nicholas, it was your recent appearance on Real Time with Bill Maher that earned a lot of attention about just this issue. Atheist writer and philosopher Sam Harris said that liberals have failed on the question of theocracy. He points to the way women and gay people are treated in large parts of the so-called Muslim world. Is it unfair to talk about the Muslim world monolithically in that way, or does he have a point?
I think it's unfair, but I do think, I mean, there is an issue of intolerance within the Islamic world, intolerance of other religions and lack of a place for women, all kinds of issues of extremism. But my problem comes when one paints or sort of projects most radical elements as kind of central to what Islam itself is. And, you know, Islam is this vast faith of 1.7 billion people. There certainly are far too many jihadis doing terrible things. But the people standing up to those jihadis are, for the most part, other Muslims. And they too are acting out of their faith. So we should speak up about that kind of extremism. But, you know, Malala, who was shot in the head for promoting girls' education, for standing up to the Taliban, she was expressing her Islamic faith every bit as much as the Taliban was. And I flinch at the way we sometimes otherize people on the basis of their faith. And I think we, you know, that we often tend to do that in the case of the Islamic world. It's huge and complex, just like everything else in the world.
On the subject of female empowerment, you recently wrote, just as you kind of began this conversation, that we've systematically overused military tools and underemployed education and women's empowerment. And that made me think of a conversation I had recently with Fred Guterl, who's the editor of Scientific American, who is concerned, among many other things, about the sustainability of world population. And so I asked him, what's the single best step we can take to make sure world population doesn't become a crisis? And he said, empowerment of women, especially in Africa. What do you think of that?
Oh, he's absolutely right. You know, if you try to think how you can, for example, reduce carbon emissions in the next 10 years, then, you know, there are different kinds of fuel, different kinds of technology, this kind of thing. If you try to think how you can reduce carbon emissions 80 years from now, if you try to think how you can reduce conflict arising from competition for resources, for water, over the decades, then one of the most important things you can do is reduce population pressures on the land and the burst of population of the numbers of people who are emitting carbon. And, you know, how do you do that? I think that in this country, we tend to think that limiting population is all about providing contraceptives. And indeed, that's important, but that kind of works in a society where people often want to limit their fertility, where they're educated in a middle class. In the developing world, you also need to change psychologies about how many children people want to have. And the most powerful way to do that is to educate girls, provide them opportunities. Every extra 4 years of education reduces the number of kids that family will have by about one child. And in the poorest countries, it's even more than that. So, you know, this is something that is not just in the interests of Ethiopia or Angola. It's also in our own interest if we care about the planet, if we care about carbon emissions, if we care about conflict.
Part of what you tend to speak about and what people really want to hear are ways that we all can help affect change. Not just learning, education is certainly important, learning about what's going around the world, but thinking about what we can do. So we think about young girls, women in Africa, around the world, female empowerment. Some people choose to give to charities that have certain causes and things that of that nature. Others want to help in other ways. How do you answer the question when people say, I see the problems you're reporting on, what can I do?
It's always sort of a challenge for a journalist because people want to know the answer. And of course, there isn't the answer. There are a million answers. For some people, it's going to be writing checks. For other people, it's volunteering. For others, it's advocacy. And there's no silver bullet that solves global problems. It can be girls' education is something I believe in very deeply. Global health issues are extraordinarily powerful when you can save a life or some modest investment or restore somebody's eyesight with $20 cataract surgery. And there's so many things one can do that are really powerful. And I don't think one should neglect issues in this country. And providing help to kids in our own backyard, whether it's mentoring teenagers or supporting early childhood education, those are powerful too. So what I normally tell people is, find something that you care about, maybe because of your own background or something you've read, but don't try to do everything, but try to, find one thing that really speaks to you, and then find a pathway depending on your resources. If you have time, then volunteer. If you've got a bank account, then maybe write a check, but get engaged in some form, and ideally not just in a superficial way, but really regularly in ways that will enrich you as well as others.
Talking to Nicholas Kristof for a few more minutes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and best-selling author who is in Rochester this week as a guest of MCC. And give us an example somewhere around the world where you have seen great progress. One of the things I appreciate about your work is you not only highlight problems, but you tell us some of these success stories that help us see potential and possibility. What's one that stands out to you recently?
I'll give you two examples. When I first traveled in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa in 1982, the thing that just really left me most pained was the leprosy and the blindness, that in every capital you'd go to, there would be so many middle-aged people who had the indignity, the pain, the suffering from leprosy or from going blind. And you travel around today, and so many fewer people are affected. Leprosy has dropped by more than 90%. It will be licked as a public health challenge around the world. Blindness as well. Jimmy Carter has made huge strides against river blindness. Cataracts are, as I said, easily corrected now for $20, $30 for an adult. And trachoma can be prevented for 75 cents a person over the course of 3 years through free medicines. And, you think about that. What an incredible opportunity we have for $25 to give somebody their vision back. That's an incredible opportunity.
And now what about political leaders? If you talk about making female empowerment a goal for all of us, it would also have to become a goal for political leaders. And like you've said, it's easier to sort of reduce foreign policy into much more oversimplified ideas as opposed to tackling hard problems that take time. You wrote that female empowerment happens agonizingly slowly, and political leaders like things that they can put on a slogan or show in 2 or 4 years' time. How do we make political leaders make female empowerment around the world an actual agenda?
I think that there is growing appreciation of its power as a transformative strategy because it works, and the most powerful advocate for it has probably been the Pentagon, because it's really kind of fascinating to be in Afghanistan and to hear some hard-bitten general one moment discussing airstrikes and the next moment talking about getting more girls in school, because they see that when there are more girls in school, that's when the Taliban is weakened. The Pentagon understands this and is a much more powerful voice for girls' education than some, bleeding heart liberal New York Times columnist. So these attitudes they are changing. Aid groups are realizing that if you invest in girls, You just get more bang for the buck than when you invest in boys or men. So we're making progress, but boy, there's so much more room to go.
There's a lot of countries with problems around the world right now. When you look around, what worries you the most? What problem looks to be the most intractable right now?
You know, we've made great strides on health metrics, on mortality. What we haven't really made a lot of progress on is, if you will, the psychology of poverty. Both abroad and at home, you get communities where people have given up. They just see no hope. And these are often, you know, kids raised in a vortex of violence and poverty and hopelessness. They self-medicate with drugs or alcohol, and then that hopelessness becomes self-fulfilling. And we see that in the slums of Kenya, and we see that in West Virginia, where 20% of kids are born with drugs or alcohol in their system. We see that in plenty of places, and that's a hard thing to crack. I think that a lot of it is early interventions. I think, you know, some of it is providing new mechanisms of hope, but I think that has been a more potent challenge than anybody had appreciated.
Is that partially the reason that you've been writing recently on, as we look at educational reform, you're more interested in the early stuff, the pre-K, the early intervention, as opposed to a lot of what becomes adult political battles in terms of reform?
Yeah, I think we should all try to be less ideological and more evidence-based, and there's pretty solid evidence that the brain is developing very, very quickly early in life, and that kids aren't as resilient as we think, and that when kids have been exposed to a lot of trouble, when they haven't been exposed to a lot of conversation, to being read to being hugged, if you will, then they're not as well prepared for life, and they can be marked. And it's not that one should give up on them after that, but it's an awful lot easier to invest in the front end in a six-month-old or a six-year-old than it is to try to turn a troubled 16-year-old around. And I think one of the reasons our anti-poverty interventions in America haven't been more effective is that too often we start too late.
Let's end on an optimistic note then. This week on this program, we've been having discussions on the rising cost of college, the decisions that many high school students are making this week, where to go, where they think they can afford it, where to accept financial aid. And you recently had some advice for what you think they ought to do after graduating high school, talking about a gap year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think that so often kids feel they need to rush off to college, and I'm a great believer in taking some time and, you know, what one does in that year, whether it's going to Bolivia to study Spanish and maybe teach English on the side, or whether it's to work at a McDonald's for a year. I think that either way, those kids will end up a year later being more ready to study, to appreciate the virtues of classes. Will probably spend less time getting drunk in fall semester or freshman year. And so I'm a great believer, you know, that certain, you know, more kids kind of taking a sabbatical, if you will, before college, especially those who are, you know, maybe not quite ready to buckle down and study. But I sure would not want that to turn into a forever vacation.
No, I the way I read it was, you know, look, it's a great big wide world, and let's not panic if we're not ready right out of high school to figure out what exactly we want to do. But I think seeing more of the world will help us all become better citizens and, you know, better people.
Yeah.
That's how I took it.
Exactly. And, of course, one can expose oneself to one can get out of one's comfort zone in China or India or Bolivia, and one can also get out of one's comfort zone in, you know, plenty of neighborhoods right in New York State. So I think that it's a useful chance to expose oneself to a different side of life that one hasn't, and to stretch oneself to get out of that comfort zone.
Nicholas Kristof, I greatly appreciate the time. I know your travels have taken you to Rochester this week, and where is work taking you soon? What are your travels coming up?
I'm going off to Los Angeles for a conference and then bouncing around a little bit, but the cool thing I'm planning next week. I'll be backpacking with my daughter on the Pacific Crest Trail in California. I'm taking a bit of a vacation, and my daughter and I are section hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in this little window of time when she's strong enough and I'm not yet decrepit. So we've done Oregon and Washington, and now we're tackling California.
Well, congratulations on that. Enjoy. And let me just say, I can confidently say on behalf of our listeners, we greatly appreciate your work. We read it all the time, and you're doing important work around the world. Thank you for taking the time for us on the program.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
That's Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist, who was a guest of MCC for their annual Scholars Day. And our great thanks to MCC for helping facilitate that interview. Short break, and we're coming back to talk about some of the themes you just heard from Nicholas Kristof. We'll talk about the way the media covers campaigns. He touched on that. Our expectations for the media. How about the way the media covers women's issues and women in politics? That and much more next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and following that Nicholas Kristof interview, it's hard to follow Nicholas Kristof, but Randy Gorbin is the journalist to do it.
Just great listening to him, and again, the kinds of people that you have on Connections on a regular basis, a lot of visiting folks here. We sometimes get folks out in their Finger Lakes, and they talk to us from our studios at WEOS, and again, all of this does take some money, and it takes support from people who enjoy this kind of programming every day. We want to continue it, but again, it's the kind of thing that even if you did it a few years ago, we need to remember we need this help all the time, and it is time for you to step up a bit, even if it's just $5, $10, whatever you can afford to do. The number is 454-6300. That's 454-6300, or just go online, wxxi.org. You can make a secure donation there, and more guests like Mr. Kristof coming along. And what a great way to kind of really talk about, Evan, just the kinds of programming you hear, not here just from WXXI News, but from NPR. I mean, some of the insightful pieces I've been listening to lately on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, not to mention Diane Rehm, just some great programming, in-depth look at what we're facing in terms of this country, the issues we're facing, what's going on in Baltimore, the presidential campaign, which starts earlier every year. And people like Kristof kind of help put that all in perspective.
Well, I always say vote with your wallet. If this matters to you, make sure it stays. And if you do that now, we will be greatly appreciative. We need you to do that. 454-6300 or wxxi.org/give. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
My guest for the remainder of the hour will help us contextualize what we just heard from Nicholas Kristof. Tom Proietti's here, the media scholar in residence from St. John Fisher College. Tom, great to see you.
Great to be here, Evan. Thanks.
Leah Stacey's here, communications professor at Nazareth College, editor-in-chief of 585 Magazine. Nice to see you, Leah.
Always a pleasure.
Well, let me start backward. Let me work backwards a bit there. Nicholas Kristof at the end talking about students and gap years. And he had some interesting comments. His column that I referenced was very interesting. He's essentially saying there's so much pressure on high school students to go out and get it right, or college graduates to go out and get a job and immediately get to work, as opposed to maybe if you can, if you've got the resources or the wherewithal, to see a little bit of the world, to recognize your place in it, to think about what you'd like to contribute to it. It was an interesting idea. Tom, gap year, yes or no?
Oh, absolutely. I taught at the college level for 44 years and saw too many 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds and even 19-year-olds come in way too early and then immediately get swallowed, not by academics, but swallowed by what he was talking about, the social environment, social freedom, the kind of insanity that goes along with that. And the students I dealt with who had gone to the military, who had taken some time off, and this was especially true at St. John Fisher, early in my career, it was with students who came back from the military, mm-hmm. From Vietnam. And at MCC, it was students frequently who were in their late 20s, early 30s, and sometimes even 40s who had been laid off from jobs and came back to college and realized that they were superhumans. And they really were some of my best students ever. So there's a lot to be said, not just even for a gap year, but for a gap period of time.
Leah?
Well, I actually did a gap year after high school.
We have to go no further.
I don't even think you knew that.
No, I didn't.
I did a gap year. I took 8 months and got my cosmetology license because I was going to be a theater major. And my dad was like, well, you can wait tables or you can go and get a skill yeah. that will pay a little bit better. And then you'll have that skill for the rest of your life. And so I still keep my license up and I do my mom's hair because I love her, and I do my husband's hair.
Do anything with this face or not?
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
We'll
oh, that's
later.
Good.
Yeah.
Put a bag over it, right?
Well, I think it does make so much sense. I wish I would have done it. I was the college graduate who felt so much pressure to find work as fast as you could, and I haven't looked back since, and I sort of wish I did. Not that I'm regretting at all how things have turned out, but I do think that there is a sense, as Mr. Kristoff says, of seeing a little bit more of the world. We have a chance to be more connected than ever. He talked about the way we all can do our own part in especially helping with women's issues around the world.
Right.
We tend to think, oh, in the United States of America, I talk to young high school students and they say, what do you need feminism for anymore? What do you need? You know, and that contextualization apparently is lacking in some ways, Tom.
Yes, it is. And before we get off the gap year, too, one of the things I think you could throw in there that really helps students a lot, and I did this for 25 years, and then I took a couple of years off, and I'm going back again in January, is international study, international education, because that kind of can work like a gap year because you're really a different person, such a distinctly different person from 18 to 22. Each one of those years is such a major milestone. And then if you want to experience things like an issue like feminism, go to a place like France or go to a place like Italy or go to a place like Saudi Arabia and see how women are treated in a completely different way and context and angle. And I think you start, it's not just feminism either. You can also, learn an awful lot just about the world and about racial relations and human relations in general. And I think one of the quickest things that happens to students who go overseas is they lose the notion of American exceptionalism. And I think that's really important that we have to get rid of that if we want to be able to deal with each other in the world.
I'm sure that will stir a little bit of the pot.
Oh, that's
good. We'll return to that comment in a moment.
I've been saying that for years.
Leah?
So, nothing new.
When it comes to the way we think about, say, feminism, the way women are treated around the world, you heard Nicholas Kristof say there are huge problems, particularly across Africa, but really, country to country. We tend to think, I think, in myopically that, hey, things seem pretty good here. Yeah, 77 cents on the dollar, but we're moving there. We're getting there.
We haven't moved at all in 40, 50 years.
What do you say to that? What do you think, Leah?
Oh, man. Well, I am...
Should say, woman.
Yeah, I should. So I'm in a position that not many women actually hold. Still, there are not many female editors, especially editor-in-chief, not many female communications professors, and there are not many who are also in their 20s. So I deal with this almost every day. It can be something as small as disrespect to something as large as, serious questions about the salary gaps. And I am very fortunate to work for a company that has a full masthead of female leadership, which is great. And to work with professors who really respect my craft. But I have actually a really relevant example. On Sunday night, I was out at a pub seeing some friends play with their band, and this guy just came up to me and said, oh, what do you do for a living? And I told him, and he said, oh, your job's easy. And I did a double take, and I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, I'm an engineer. You can't argue with, my job's so much harder than yours.
A stranger just said this to you?
Yeah, I just came up and started chatting, and he said, you're just teaching a bunch of idiots to write things, and then I have to go and read that stuff in the news, and I have to break it down for myself.
Oof.
And so
you think he would have talked to a man like that?
Absolutely.
No,
I wouldn't talk to a man or a woman like that.
No.
Yeah, and so it made me take a step back and say, this is the kind of stuff that my female students, and even my male students to some extent, and my, my future daughters are going to have to deal with. So how do I take these things and then, as he said, break them down and make them teachable and, you know, bring about change just in my small community so it builds out from there.
I think that's well said. And something
that
Tom Proietti has said for years and advocated for years is better media literacy, not just because I think it's valuable to understand the way the media works, but all of the sort of the ripple effects of being a better media consumer and more educated media consumer and understanding that. I want to play a clip if we could. And at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Cecily Strong is an SNL personality who hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And you can debate whether the White House Correspondents' Dinner is too incestuous to begin with. And but she is hosting this event, and she asked the audience to take a pledge. I was actually struck by watching Wolf Blitzer was looking unimpressed with this and refused to raise his hand. But let's listen to what Cecily Strong got the correspondents to say.
All right, guys. Now, this next part is a repeat after me, so I need your help here. I want all the media to put their hands up and swear something this election season, okay? I solemnly swear not to talk about Hillary's appearance, because that is not journalism.
If you can see the faces in the audience, there was about three quarters applauding wildly, men and women, and then there was this, the folks like Wolf Blitzer, who maybe Wolf was, I don't mean to denigrate Wolf too much here, I just think maybe he didn't want to play along with the game. But
plus it was Cecily Strong, and I think some of them just didn't take her seriously. You know, it's sometimes for comedians, especially female comedians, it's hard to be taken seriously.
I think she's one of only two or three women to host that event.
Absolutely, and she's superb at and what she did. She caught them completely off guard, and she nailed it. I mean, it's something that Leah just said a moment ago is kind of the ability to deconstruct the situation. What she did is she went backward and she said, she looked at the coverage of Hillary Clinton and all female candidates. I heard this the other day with Carly Fiorina. Immediately we're talking about how she looks. Somebody said to me, she looks like a female Richard Nixon. I said, who cares what she looks like? I don't care what she looks like.
Right.
I want to know what she can do.
And when's the last time someone said Ted Cruz looks like a male?
Whatever.
A male Margaret Thatcher. I don't know what you would say, say it about a man.
Exactly. We just don't. And that's part of the deconstructing that's in media literacy is that, you know, that's not part of the conversation, but it is for women. And that's so, so very sad.
All right, Leah. So a couple of things here. We all agree that when we see, and we're going to see people talk about Hillary's appearance, it will happen inevitably. But when we do it as consumers, I want to ask you and Tom the same question here. How do you break that? How do you stop the media? Do you penalize them? Do you contact them? Do you stop subscribing? What do you do?
When they're describing
appearance. Yeah, when they're hung up on trivial matters and especially treating women differently than the way they would treat men.
Yeah, so this is interesting because I'm a feature writer, and we rely really heavily on visuals in our descriptions. So I always encourage my students and my writers to talk about the way things look. So on the one hand, I get it, but on the other hand, you're right. We don't talk about the way that the men look. And we also don't talk about their age. I was talking with a couple of work colleagues about that earlier today, and they said, you know, it's been brought up so much, their ages. So I think it goes back to just beginning with that education. You know, if you're teaching the next generation of journalists and media consumers all together, setting that standard, saying, this is what we're going to do. If we're going to talk about appearance, we're going to talk about everybody's appearance. If we're going to talk about age, we're going to talk about everybody's age. Or we're just going to stick to the facts and just the raw, hard reporting.
If you wouldn't write about it in the same way about a man, don't write about it as well.
Exactly.
Yeah?
Okay. Treat everyone the same.
Good baseline.
It's journalism. I mean, one of the things that I've been really concerned about in the last, well, ever since 9/11 took place and we got ourselves involved in Afghanistan and in Iraq, I saw this with the Time 100 most influential people in the world. Two came from South America. And no one from Australia. So we pretty much left two continents out, and one of the ones from South America is the Pope, who hasn't been in South America as a resident for about 40 years.
Right.
So we've kind of lost sight of the rest of the world by focusing. We spend all of our attention on the Mideast, so we don't really know what's going on in anywhere else. We don't know what's going on in India. We don't know what's going on really in China. Australia, we have no knowledge of. Canadians, I could go on forever about how ignorant we are about Canada as Americans. And here we are. We know about things like, or we think we know a lot about things like ISIS and whatnot. I have no idea what those things even are, and I don't perceive them much as threats to me. I think the bigger, much larger threat is the failure of journalism that we have in a case like this and ignorance.
We're going to learn a lot more about South America and Latin America.
Yes.
Next hour on this program with Father Roy Bourgeois, by the way, and we'll get to that in about 15 minutes. And before I get to your phone calls, Mike and Aranaquet, we're going to come to you in a moment. I should mention the number if you want to call the program with Tom Proietti, media scholar in residence from St. John Fisher College, Leah Stacey, communications professor at Nazareth College, and the editor-in-chief of 585 Magazine. They're here talking about media literacy, reacting to some of what you heard from New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof earlier this hour. You can call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 if you want to get in on the conversation. And I want to address very briefly a point that Leah just made, which is an important one. I'm someone who I've written a book about men and women in a single industry, and somebody actually said to me, you're right about what they wear a lot. Like, I don't want to hear one more description of what that guy like. But I said, well, look, I did not want, and my wife is a fantastic photographer. I didn't want pictures in my book because I wanted the challenge of writing effectively and evocatively, and I wanted to put you in the room with them. And that is describing what's on the wall, what's on the floor, what they're wearing, how much stubble the guy had, all that stuff. That's different, though, than fixating throughout a presidential campaign every darn day. What is Hillary wearing? Is it a powerful enough pantsuit or some what color is she wearing? What does it say? Don't you think, Leah, there's something different?
Yeah, we don't care how her makeup looks. We don't care if her hair's on her face. Just talk about the facts, because that's what America needs to hear right now.
Well, amen. Let me get to the phones, and I see the phones are lighting up. Mike and Aranaquet, you're first. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for a wonderful program. In fact, every day is a good one.
Well, thank you, Mike.
My feeling is the media is being duped to cover the Republicans and cover the Republicans and cover the Republicans who's doing what. I really don't believe the Republicans care about the presidency. They care about state houses. They care about state legislatures. That's what they're working on, because it's divide and conquer. They're sucking all the oxygen out of the air by having the media fill up with all the, what did somebody call it? The Republican clown car.
The clown car.
All right, Mike, let me jump in and say, I don't want this to devolve too much into sort of a right
name
and left
calling,
thing.
Right.
But I will say, to Mike's point, I think Republicans have 30 or 32 governorships, and that certainly is a powerful hold. I don't think Republicans don't care about the presidency.
Absolutely, they do care deeply.
I think
deeply.
They care very much about the presidency.
Yeah, they care deeply about the presidency, and that's a really important place to be, and it's a place that sets the tone, not just for the United States, for the world. You know, it's the most powerful position in the world. But I think Mike makes a very good point about the Republicans spending an awful lot of time at local-level politics and trying to move that, because ultimately, as Tip O'Neill used to say over and over again, all politics is local.
That's the trenches, and the media likes the big, sexy stuff, the presidential
yes.
races. It's easier to cover that as opposed
yes.
to getting down.
Well, and
the
mistake they make is covered like a horse race.
Yeah, boy.
It's all wrong.
We talk about that all the time. If you want to talk about the horse race, I can spend 5 minutes on that, but I'd rather talk substance. And the media, the Mark Halperins of the world,
yes.
fixate on the horse race. Back to the phones, Paul and Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi. Just a quick comment. I was interested to hear a comment earlier about the emphasis on appearance that we might be subject to over the next year and a half. And also, the fact that what strikes me as funny about this is the upcoming generation of journalists that are being taught right now, that have been brought up on Facebook and Twitter, probably spend 90% of their time commenting on people's appearance and the appearance of things in general. So I have a feeling this trend is going to be with us for quite a while.
Paul, thanks for the call.
I'm going to disagree. Because
I think that's a little oversimplified.
I have about 30 great conversations going on online right now, and just on Facebook, let alone Twitter, that are really highly substantial in nature. In fact, one of the greatest ones I have going on right now has to do with a Tesla battery discovery or announcement of this week. So I disagree completely, Paul. I think you're simplifying it.
Yeah. All you got to do is walk into a classroom and start a conversation with the kids who are in school right now. We got to stop underestimating them. They are deep human beings. just like we all like to think about our own generation, and they have a lot of things to say. And they're tired of the aesthetic, too. They really are.
They're tired of this idea, and we saw the ostensible study recently that millennials are the dumbest generation.
Garbage.
And they're aware of that.
Garbage.
Well,
it's absolute garbage.
Fair enough. And Leah, you're saying they're aware of that stereotype. And
oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They resent it immensely.
Yeah.
Well, and they should.
I hope they do resent it. Millennials, if you're listening, I really do hope you resent it and you push back in substantive ways. Curran in Penfield. Go ahead, Curran.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for talking about the gap year. I'm 22 years old, and I graduated from high school. I took 2 years off and moved to California and learned more about culture and lifestyle of people from that era that I could ever imagine. And I just want to tell any millennial out there, don't be afraid to take those 2 years or 1 year or whatever. It doesn't matter if you feel like you're not up to step with your friends, because those are the two best years I've ever taken off in my life. And I just thank you guys for encouraging that a lot. It really makes a difference in somebody's life to learn more about life than just studies.
Well said,
Touché,
Curran.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yes.
Yeah, thanks very much. In fact, building off Curran's point there, Victor writes to us on the web. He writes in and talking about, he said, Tom mentioned during the discussion on the gap year, eliminating U.S. exceptionalism. Great point. I believe the better term is hubris or pride gone bad.
Yes. I mean, we can call it all kinds of things. One of the greatest things I ever go through with my students is landing in London. You fly overnight, you're exhausted, you're jet lagged, and you land in London, and it's 10 o'clock in the morning, you go to Windsor Castle, and you realize that, and this happens to my students, is they realize that there are places in the world that are just as cool as the United States, and maybe even cooler. Maybe even cooler. And they look around, and they're like, wow. And then you tell them, oh, by the way, it's been here for about 2,000 years longer than we have, and it's the source of just about all that we have. So American exceptionalism it's a mess.
The issue I have is this mutually exclusive, this bifurcation, this construct that we have to live with, which is either you think we're the greatest country ever and
right.
God has bestowed on us this great responsibility, or you hate this country. That's silly. Most of the people that I hear say that we are the absolute greatest and God has elevated us to some weird place have never left this country.
Right. But, xenophobes.
But that doesn't mean, and those who are occasionally critical or praise other places, doesn't mean that we don't appreciate the value and the greatness and the opportunity of this country.
I love coming home, and where's the deed to my property and the mortgage that I hold? It's in Rochester, New York, USA. I love coming home to the USA.
Yeah, there you go.
But I do appreciate the rest of the world.
Okay. And regarding, Keith writes to us regarding whether Republicans care about the presidency. He just points out that presidents choose Supreme Court justices.
Yes, they do.
Republicans definitely care.
Sure do.
I think absolutely right. Keith, Mike writes to us, he thinks Tom is dead wrong. He says the media is doing exactly what their employers are directing them to, selling their employer's point of view to help them acquire more money and power. Given the sorry state of education in the country, they have a fairly easy job.
That's one of the reasons why, and I will agree with him for most of the commercial media. I have to say he's probably right. I think for most of the non-commercial media, and I think most media interchange now takes place between and amongst people using social media platforms, and that's much more important content. And last I checked, I don't really work for anyone when it comes to how I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Yeah. Comment from David on Twitter, and I want to start with Leah on this one. He says, we do talk about men's appearances when they're fat. Just ask Chris Christie. He chose the most extreme example I could think of, but does he have a point at all?
He absolutely has a point there. Yeah.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, but you know, it's kind of thing Christie invited into the discussion.
How did he invite that in?
Well, he really did. I mean, he made it an issue. He talked about how he was going to lose weight. He did lose weight. He put it back on, and you know, he left himself wide open. And then he's the first to joke about it. So you remember his late night talk show appearances. Almost always, he's the one that brings up the weight issue because he realizes, you know, I hate to say this, the 500-pound elephant in the room. But in Chris Christie's case, you know, it really is.
Now let me hit Nick's comment. He says, he generally fully agrees with what he's hearing. Journalists who report on female candidates' appearance are inane and not worth listening to. Maybe not completely sexist to compare Fiorina to Nixon, he says, since Nixon specifically lost the public opinion for disheveled appearance in a debate. Interesting.
Well, I don't think he wasn't disheveled.
And he was not shaven and not wearing makeup.
He was shaven. He just didn't have the right makeup on.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's hitting at an interesting point, and that might be a great conversation someday about how what we're seeing when we see a politician, especially at the presidential level, is not the real person. If you could see them when they wake up in the morning with no makeup on, and realize that they look like you and me. They don't look like the people that we see.
Check out Amy Schumer's recent music video on the subject, which is fabulous. Just fabulous on makeup. Amy Schumer is
She is unbelievable.
I'm breaking news for all of you. Amy Schumer, I'm always bringing new actually, I'm always the last person to know about things, but Amy Schumer's fantastic. And to Nick's point on Nixon, I think it doesn't speak well of us that we all remember how Nixon looked and not the content of those debates.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a good thing either. Last quick comments. We got about 15 seconds each. Are you optimistic, Leah Stacey, going into the presidential campaign that where the media is growing up, or are we dumbing down?
I wouldn't be teaching if I wasn't optimistic.
And I wouldn't be here if I wasn't optimistic either.
You guys really are such optimists. And I do appreciate that, because we can be a little tough on the media, and sometimes the media needs it.
They do.
Well, I think if that's part of the point of my advocacy about media literacy is we let them get away with far too much. Early on, you asked, what should we do? Scare the people in the newsroom and send in a negative comment.
That's good.
Terrifies.
Yeah. Hold them accountable when media is inane.
Yes.
But praise them when they're not.
Absolutely.
And there's still a lot going. This is a pledge week, and this is a perfect chance for me to be a homer. But I'll tell you that we care about this so much here. And I do think NPR and our affiliates are really trying to bring you longer conversations, more depth. Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, and Mike Huckabee were all profiled in 24 hours with 8-minute pieces on NPR. You won't see anything like that anywhere else. Tom Proietti, Leah Stacey, wonderful to talk to you. We need more time. Come back soon, I hope.
Yeah.
Please.
Thank you to both of you.
Honored.
And our thanks to MCC and Nicholas Kristof earlier this hour. Short break and right back on Connections.